morning. This is the KBOO Morning News for Tuesday, February 21st, 2006. I'm Becca Bartleson.
And I'm Chris Andre.
Today, the Oregon Supreme Court will hand down its ruling on Measure 37. The Bush administration's latest victim is clean water. And in the Philippines, hope is running out for people inside a school buried 100 feet under a mudslide. Portland area weather today, showers to the north, snow at higher altitudes, highs in the 40s. Tonight, mostly cloudy with a chance of rain or snow, temperatures in the 30s to low 40s.
The fate of Oregon's property compensation law will be settled today when the Oregon Supreme Court is scheduled to release a decision about legal challenges to it. Voters passed the law, Measure 37, in 2004. The measure requires government to pay landowners for property value losses caused by regulation or to forgo the regulations completely. There are, however, exceptions. The law was challenged in a lawsuit filed last year by 7 landowners and the watchdog group, 1,000 Friends of Oregon. Judge Mary James ruled on October 14th in Marion County Circuit Court that the measure violated 5 state and federal constitutional provisions, including one barring discrimination. Measure 37 opponents argued that the measure created 2 unequal classes of landowners in Oregon. The Supreme Court bypassed the Court of Appeals and took the case directly. The 7 justices heard arguments on January 10th. The outcome of the ruling is anyone's guess. This from the Salem Statesman Journal.
Oregon State's Attorney General Office has filed a lawsuit against a Portland business that is gathering signatures for several proposed ballot measures, claiming some workers have not been paid. The complaint against Brian Platt and his business, BNP Campaign Management, was filed on behalf of the State Bureau of Labor and Industries. It seeks unpaid wages on behalf of 3 initiative petition circulators and asks the judge to enjoin this business from paying employees less than minimum wage. The lawsuit alleges that Platt failed to pay about $1,700 in wages to 3 workers, along with more than $10,000 in penalty wages. Platt says he has not seen the lawsuit yet, but he denies the allegations. His company was gathering signatures for initiatives that included proposals to allow federal exemptions on state income taxes, change elections for state Supreme Court and Court of Appeals judges, and bar eminent domain for some private development.
1 in 5 Oregon high school graduates dropped out of public university statewide before their sophomore year in 2004. Despite many who earned a B average in college prep classes, more than 1,300 graduates of Oregon high schools found themselves unprepared for the demands of college. Most of the students who quit college were barely earning a C average, putting them at the threshold for academic probation. Graduates of private high schools didn't fare much better than graduates of public schools. Statewide, 17% of private high school graduates who entered state universities in 2004 dropped out, compared with 19% of public high school graduates. But the results differed dramatically among high schools. There are also striking differences among universities. Educators at schools with strong track records say tough high school courses help students do better in college.
Efforts are growing on U.S. campuses to encourage divestment in Sudan to influence the situation in the Darfur region. FSRN's Melinda Tuhus reports on the latest success from Yale University.
Yale University has announced that it will not invest in 7 oil companies doing business in Sudan and will divest of its holdings in at least 1 oil company that operates there. The university's decision was based on a report by the International Human Rights Clinic at Yale Law School. The report cited Sudanese government support for the Janjaweed, the Arab militias implicated in the genocide in Darfur. Nick Robinson is a third-year law student at Yale and one of the main authors of the report. He says oil revenues make up half of Sudan's budget and that military spending has increased alongside rising oil income.
The government of Sudan is buying helicopters and airplanes that have been used to bomb villages in Darfur. They have used that money to pay off the Janjaweed to carry out many of these atrocities. And they've used the money to buy weapons that have then gone into further fuel the conflict.
The oil companies in question are based in China and India. U.S. companies are barred by a 1997 presidential order from operating in Sudan. Yale joins Harvard, Stanford, and a few other universities in divestment from Sudan. For FSRN, I'm Melinda Tuhus in New Haven.
The Supreme Court will take up a property rights case today that could greatly curtail the federal law credited with cleaning up the nation's rivers, lakes, and bays after decades of industrial pollution. The Clean Water Act of 1972 made it illegal to discharge pollutants without a permit into the navigable waters of the United States. Federal regulators read this measure as protecting tens of thousands of small streams and hundreds of millions of acres of wetlands that flow toward larger waterways, even if they are afar from the nearest river or bay. But to the surprise of environmentalists, the High Court agreed to hear a direct attack on that broad view of the law. Farmers and developers say it is far-fetched to describe low-lying farm fields or even dry creek beds in the West as part of the nation's navigable waterways. Today, however, the High Court will hear the case of John Rapanos, a Michigan developer who is fined $13 million in a long-running legal battle that began when he defied federal agents by filling in 22 acres of wetlands he owns about 20 miles from Lake Huron. Environmentalists fear that a win for Rapanos could dramatically cut back one of the nation's most effective anti-pollution laws.
Fish that leap into passing boats may be a fisherman's fantasy, but scientists fear that hyperactive Asian carp will reach the U.S. Great Lakes, devour the base of the food chain, and spoil drinking water for 40 million people. In less than a decade since escaping southern U.S. fish farms, the hardy and voracious carp have come to dominate sections of the Mississippi River and its tributaries. The leaping fish are silver carp that jump haphazardly when alarmed by passing boats and have injured boaters, some of whom have taken up garbage can lids as shields. The only barriers between dense populations of silver and bighead carp and the world's largest collective body of freshwater are a few miles of waterway and a little tested underwater electric field spanning a canal near Chicago. The idea of adding a few more varieties of fish to the Great Lakes would not appear catastrophic in light of the range of global environmental crises. The Great Lakes has been abused by polluters, overfished, invaded by scores of unwanted species, and repopulated with non-native fish to eat invaders and please anglers. But scientists believe the carp, which escaped lagoons in Arkansas during late 1990s flooding, could set off an ecological collapse in the lakes, running the primarily recreational 5 billion fishery and opposing a threat to water quality for millions of people. This according to Reuters.
Animal-to-human disease transmission has recently been observed to be taking place unnaturally fast. According to U.S. and Scottish scientists, three-quarters, that's 75%, of the 38 species of harmful organisms and viruses identified in the past 25 years are thought to have jumped from animals to humans. The researchers said should the potentially lethal H5N1 strain of bird flu mutate into a virus that can spread between humans, it would simply be part of an alarming ongoing trend. Scientists now know that 1,400 kinds of bacteria, viruses, protozoa, fungi, and worms that can affect human health. Professor Mark Woolhouse from the University of Edinburgh said the rising number of infections passing from animals to humans could be due to human activity such as global travel and trade and the expansion of cities into natural habitats such as rainforests. He said a vast range of animals carried organisms that could infect humans. They include everything from cows to chickens, rats, bats, and palm civets, which spread the SARS virus. This according to The Guardian.
The top U.S. envoy for public diplomacy yesterday defended the conditions at the prison at Guantanamo Bay. Undersecretary of State Karen Hughes said the detainees were not criminals, but warriors. In an interview with the Arabic-language Al Jazeera satellite channel, Hughes said the about 490 prisoners held in Guantanamo were arrested for waging a war against the United States or for helping Al-Qaeda or the Taliban in their wars. The interview aired with an Arabic voiceover, and Hughes' direct quotes in English were not immediately available. Hughes said the UN report was written by people who did not visit Guantanamo. Hughes said the detainees were people who had made public their intention to kill as many Americans as possible and that the U.S. government had a right to defend its citizens. She added that some of those released from Guantanamo have immediately gone back to fighting and killing Americans. UN investigator for torture Manfred Nowak has said that the detainees at Guantanamo should be released or brought before an independent court. He added that the United States should give the United Nations access to other detention centers, including the secret ones, in Iraq, Afghanistan, and elsewhere.
Looks like another bad week to be Michael Chertoff. President Bush named his Homeland Security Secretary as the U.S. point person to work with Mexican officials to clamp down on increasing violence along the U.S.-Mexican border. White House spokesman Scott McClellan made the announcement after Bush talked by telephone with his Mexican counterpart, Vicente Fox, to discuss immigration and border violence, which has surged in recent months. McClellan said the leaders decided to pick a high-level contact within each government to work together on the issue, and Bush tapped Chertoff for the role. Attacks on American border guards jumped more than 100% last year to 778 as U.S. agents confronted often heavily armed Mexican smugglers running drugs and undocumented immigrants into the country. Bush's talk with Fox comes after the U.S. envoy to Mexico last month accused the country's government of failing to control crime. Border violence has increased since Fox declared war on drug cartels a year ago. This according to Reuters.
The planned execution of Michael Morales was delayed until tonight after two anesthesiologists refused to participate because of ethical concerns. With the execution scheduled for 12:01 a.m. Tuesday, defense lawyers requested a stay from the federal judge who last week ordered San Quentin State Prison to have an anesthesiologist on hand to minimize Michael Angelo Morales' pain as he was put to death by lethal injection. A second anesthesiologist was retained as a backup.
In a seven-year-old secret program at the National Archives, intelligence agencies have been removing from public access thousands of historical documents that were available for years. The restoration of classified status to more than 55,000 previously declassified pages began in 1999 when the Central Intelligence Agency and five other agencies objected to what they saw as a hasty release of sensitive information after a 1995 declassification order signed by President Bill Clinton. It accelerated after the Bush administration took office and especially after the 2001 attacks. The secret reclassification program continued virtually without outside notice until December. That was when an intelligence historian, Matthew Aid, noticed that dozens of documents he'd copied years ago had been withdrawn from the archive's open shelves. After Aid and other historians complained, the archive's Information Security Oversight Office, which oversees government classification, began an audit of the reclassification program. Under existing guidelines, government documents are supposed to be declassified after 25 years unless there is particular reason to keep them secret. While some of the choices made by the security reviewers at the archives are baffling, others seem guided by an old bureaucratic reflex to cover up embarrassments even if they occurred half a century ago. This from the New York Times.
The Energy Department has said it's come up with $5 million to immediately restore jobs cut at a renewable energy laboratory President Bush will visit today. The move will avoid a potentially embarrassing movement as the president promotes his energy plan. In his State of the Union speech last month, Bush called for the United States to use less Middle Eastern oil and develop an alternative energy sources, including renewable energy such as wind, solar power, and biomass. Bush proposed spending millions more dollars in renewable energy research. However, Democratic lawmakers and environmentalists questioned the administration's commitment when jobs were being eliminated at the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, NREL, in Golden, Colorado. Bush will visit the lab to tout his proposal for more renewable energy research funding. They ensure the Colorado laboratory will have the people to carry out that research. The Energy Department transferred $5 million over the weekend to the Midwest Research Institute, the contractor that operates the Renewable Energy Lab, to restore all jobs cut earlier this month due to budget shortfalls. This, according to Reuters.
An Ohio video surveillance firm has apparently become the first company in the U.S. to implant microchips under the skin of key personnel. FSRN's Allison Rome reports.
Two employees and the CEO of Cincinnati-based firm CityWatcher now have silicon chips embedded in their arms. The firm says it is testing the radio frequency identification device, or RFID, as a way to control employee access to high-security rooms. Microchip manufacturer Verichip received approval from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration in 2004 to implant the RFIDs in humans. The company is also working with a network of hospitals to install chip reading machines in emergency rooms. Privacy advocates worry that the signal could be picked up by other chip readers, but Verichip denies that claim. They further state that RFIDs do not emit signals, so the movements of workers like those at City Watcher can't be monitored. For Free Speech Radio News in Columbus, Ohio, I'm Allison Rahm.
Former Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad has said disgraced U.S. lobbyist Jack Abramoff was paid $1.2 million to organize a meeting between himself and President Bush in 2002. Mahathir denied that money came from the Malaysian government. He did say, however, he was aware the payment was made to Abramoff, but he didn't know who made it. Mahathir said that at the time he had been persuaded by the Heritage Foundation in Washington to meet with Bush because the conservative think tank believed he could help influence Bush in some way regarding U.S. policies. Abramoff allegedly contacted presidential adviser Karl Rove at least four times to help arrange a meeting between Mahathir and Bush, which took place in May 2002 in the Oval Office. Mahathir visited the White House at a time when Malaysia had emerged as a key U.S. ally in America's so-called War on Terror.
A severe winter storm caused utility crews to work through the weekend to restore power to thousands of people from Maine to Michigan. And as states scattered to open shelters for residents left without energy, some lawmakers are turning to Venezuela for aid. On the East Coast, New York and Massachusetts have already accepted more than 20 million gallons of heating oil at 40% discount from Venezuela's state-run oil company, Petróleos de Venezuela, and its Houston-based U.S. affiliate, Citgo Petroleum, which has offered cities in the United States millions of gallons of low-cost fuel. And as FSRN's Sarah Turner reports from Wisconsin, some Midwestern cities want a part of the action.
Due to federal funding cuts, cities across the country are facing financial crises, and residents are wondering how much it will cost to heat their homes this winter or take the bus to work. The capital city of Wisconsin, Madison, is currently waiting for an offer from the Venezuelan government for low-cost diesel fuel that might reduce the financial burden of a cash-strapped bus system. The Chicago Transit Authority also received an offer of discounted fuel for their city's bus fleet, which was initially turned down, claiming an incompatibility of fuels. However, after widespread public outcry and renewed offers from Venezuela, the CTA has come back to the table and is examining alternatives. Madison City Council member Austin King.
Every time Metro faces a problem, the only two solutions that consistently come before us are raise fares or cut routes. And when you raise fares or cut routes, you end up with less ridership, which means you have less income, which means that next time you have to raise fares or cut routes again. So what we have here is an opportunity, and I really think it's absolutely worth exploring to the fullest extent possible, to have a different solution to the Metro fiscal crisis, and that is getting a different stream of low-cost diesel fuel to run the buses.
Those opposing the deal say the U.S. shouldn't accept fuel from a Latin American leader who's denounced President Bush and U.S.-style capitalism. Steve Johnson is the senior Latin American policy analyst for the conservative political research group, the Heritage Foundation.
You could view it as accepting a campaign contribution from a foreign country that happens to operate a state hydrocarbon monopoly that may be eager to polish its image. Or you could view it as a political intervention to become sort of a partisan player in U.S. domestic politics, something that's legal here, but that would be considered illegal in some other countries.
Madison does face potential hurdles to the deal. The city currently uses a special type of low-sulfur diesel, and a different type of fuel might require switching the fuel pumps for all city buses. Another concern is how long Venezuela would be able to provide the low-cost fuel. But supporters of the proposal don't think these obstacles are insurmountable. Ben Mansky has been in ongoing contact with the Venezuelan embassy. He approached the Venezuelan government several weeks ago after hearing about the offer to the city of Chicago. As a fellow with the Liberty Tree Foundation for the Democratic Revolution, a national nonprofit based in Madison, Mansky believes this is an opportunity to build ties between local municipalities.
In the U.S., cities are becoming more and more centers of democracy and of innovation. And there's a couple reasons for that. And number one, You see the federal and state governments taking less and less responsibility, becoming less and less accountable to the American people. And you see the American people, I think, increasingly reacting to that and looking for new ways to exercise power and to provide services and to take care of the weakest among us. And so at the local level, at the city level, there's still a perception that people can have influence, that they can have access to government, and that city government might be able to do some things for people that the federal and state governments have surrendered.
If a deal is offered, Madison Common Council members would need to approve the deal with a simple majority vote. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Sarah Turner.
It looks like relations between the United States and Venezuela have been thawing. Then the relationship suffered a severe setback only a day after Bernardo Alvarez, Venezuela's ambassador to the U.S., met with Assistant Secretary of State Thomas Shannon. U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice said the Bush administration is working on creating a united front of countries against Venezuela. According to the Venezuelan embassy in the U.S., Venezuela has had been requesting an official meeting with the State Department ever since November 2005. The Alvarez-Shannon meeting covered a wide variety of issues such as energy, commerce, and the extradition of Venezuelan-Cuban Luis Posada Carriles, who is wanted for terrorism in Venezuela. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, speaking at a U.S. Senate budget hearing on the weekend, said, "I think it's fair to say that one of the biggest problems that we face in that regard are the policies of Venezuela, which are attempting to influence neighbors away from the democratic process." Also, Venezuela's relationship to Cuba, said Rice, is a particular danger to the region.
Mexican crews tunneled feverishly through dirt and rock yesterday to reach 65 coal miners trapped by a gas explosion 600 feet underground. Relatives grew increasingly desperate after nightfall with no word of their loved ones. Officials said that while prospects were dim, there was still a chance of finding survivors from Sunday morning's gas explosion at the Pasa de Conchos mine near the town of San Juan de Sabinas. The trapped men had carried only 6 hours of oxygen, but officials said they believe a ventilation system that uses huge fans to pump in fresh air and suck out dangerous gases was still working. Even so, they could not be certain the precious oxygen was arriving to where the miners were trapped. More than 36 hours of digging had pushed rescue teams only 450 yards into the mine, about 50 yards from where two conveyor belt operators were believed to be trapped. And others thought that they were trapped as far as 3 miles from the mine's entrance. This, according to The Guardian.
Militants in the Niger Delta mounted fresh attacks on oil installations yesterday, extending a wave of sabotage which has crippled exports from Africa's leading oil producer. The guerrillas seized a Nigerian army post in waterways east of the city of Wari after soldiers fled, allowing them to dynamite a floating barracks block and an oil pipeline operated by Royal Dutch Shell. A Shell spokeswoman confirmed the oil pipeline attack and said the boat was abandoned when the attackers blew it up. The Anglo-Dutch multinational, the biggest foreign operator in Nigeria, has evacuated all its facilities in the immediate area, a stretch of creeks and swamps, which normally produces 500,000 barrels a day. The attack sent oil prices surging in London amid concern that the world's eighth-largest producer was facing months of turmoil. Despite reassurances from the International Energy Agency, IEA, threats of a further attack from the rebels against installations in the Niger Delta pushed up the price of a barrel of Brent crude to almost $62 a barrel. Yesterday's violence followed a series of raids at the weekend, which damaged several installations and resulted in the kidnap of 9 foreign employees of a Shell subsidiary. A spokesman for the militants said their fate has not been decided. This from The Guardian.
According to Reuters, the Bush administration has failed to put adequate security conditions on a deal for a state-owned Dubai company to manage major U.S. ports. Representative Peter King, chairman of the House of Representatives Homeland Security Committee, said the deal should not go forward pending a full investigation. Lawmakers from both parties joined in criticizing the plan, and one called the administration tone-deaf for approving it. King said that before the administration approved the sale of British firm P&O, which manages 6 U.S. ports to Dubai Ports of the World, Dubai Ports World of the United Arab Emirates, it failed to determine whether the company could be trusted. Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff, defending the deal, said the administration approved it after a classified review and included provisions to protect national security. King said the safeguards did not go far enough, but that he could not disclose classified details about them. Now it looks like the deal may go through for foreign ports, but not for American ones.
UN's Ambassador Zalmay Khalilzad delivered a blunt warning to Iraqi leaders yesterday that they risk losing American support unless they establish a national unity government with the police and the army out of the hands of religious parties. He delivered the warning as another 24 people died in a string of bombings, underscoring the need for the country to establish a government capable of winning the trust of all communities and ending the violence. During a rare news conference, he said division among the country's sectarian and ethnic communities was the fundamental problem in Iraq, fueling the Sunni Arab-dominated insurgency and the wave of reprisal killings. The ambassador said Iraq's next cabinet ministers have to be people who are non-sectarian, broadly accepted, and who are not tied to militias run by political parties. Otherwise, he warned that Iraq faces the risk of warlordism that Afghanistan went through for a period. He also reminded the Iraqis that the United States has spent billions to build up Iraq's police and army and said, "We are not going to invest the resources of the American people and build forces that are run by people who are sectarian and tied to the militias," some of which, the ambassador said, received arms and trainings from Iran.
Today's digging at the scene of a Philippine landslide has been hampered by more rain. Troops and volunteers have been digging at the site where it's believed a school once stood, and at another site 200 yards away where some think the building may have been carried by a wall of mud. U.S. Marines alongside Philippine troops and technical experts from Malaysia and Taiwan finally had to move away from the first site when the holes they dug in the mud kept collapsing. Hopes are fading that anyone will be found alive, but the rescue work is continuing. About 1,000 people are still missing and feared dead. This has been the KBOO Morning News for Tuesday, February 21st, 2006. Chris Andre edited the news. KBOO Newsroom volunteers and reporters produced and edited the tape. Kathleen Stevenson is the AM News and Public Affairs Director. I'm Chris Andre.
And I'm Becca Bartleson.
Thanks for listening. We clear the air at 90.7 FM in Portland, 100.7 FM in Corvallis on translator K264AA, 91.9 FM in Hood River on translator K220HR. Be sure to join us for the KBOO Evening News at 5 p.m. today. Want to know what goes on in the KBOO Morning Newsroom? If you have the guts to help make the sausage, volunteer in AM Newsroom. Call Kathleen Stevenson at 503-231-8032, extension 202. Portland area weather today, showers to the north, snow at higher altitudes, highs in the 40s tonight, mostly cloudy, chance of rain or snow, temperatures in the 30s to low 40s. Coming up this morning on your community radio station, at 7:30, Joe Uris and Abe Proctor host Talk Radio. At 9 on Between the Covers, Julie Sabatier interviews Stephen Elliott, editor of Stumbling and Raging, an anthology of politically inspired fiction by some of today's writers. At 9:30, we'll check with Phyllis Johansson about Spay Day USA in Oregon. And guess what that one's about? That will be followed by Environment and Human Well-Being, a talk by award-winning scientist Jane Lubchenco, who teaches at Oregon State University. And at 10:30, the topic on stage and studio, the intelligent design of Jenny Chow at Portland Center Stage, and we'll hear Damali Ayo's street performance as she panhandles for reparations in Living Flag. And stay with us, because at 11 o'clock we'll be having Democracy Now with Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.
Here is the KBOO Community Calendar for Tuesday, 21 February 2006. The Clark County Young Democrats invite you to a meeting on Tuesday, February 21st at 8 p.m. at the Blind Onion on Mill Plain Boulevard in Vancouver. The current officers' terms are up, so it's time for elections again. But if you're not interested in running, bring your input on what we want this organization to do and where to go from here. It's a new year, and so a perfect time for a new start. Again, that's the Clark County Young Democrats meeting, 8 p.m. tonight at the Blind Onion, 2900 East Mill Plain Boulevard in Vancouver. Learn about the Women of Afghanistan Today, an interactive exhibit focusing on the work of the Revolutionary Women of Afghanistan Association and the cultural changes women have had to deal with during decades of war and government upheaval in Afghanistan. The location is Portland State University, 724 Southwest Harrison in Portland, Tuesday, February 21st, 2006, 7:30 a.m. to 11 p.m. This event is free. At the library, you can see the work of Young People in New Avenues for Youth program as they present an exhibit of art that examines some of the causes of homelessness and shows what being homeless means to them. This exhibit is hosted by the Multnomah County Central Library, 801 Southwest 10th Avenue, Portland. Admission to this exhibit is free and is on view during library hours starting at 10 a.m. And that is the KBOO Community Calendar for Tuesday, February 21st, 2006.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the third annual Oregon Queer Youth Conference. The conference is open to lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, transsexual, queer, questioning, and intersex youth and their allies under the age of 23 to get together, discuss the issues, and have a crazy cool time. The conference takes place at the Caitlin Gable School, located at 8825 Southwest Barnes Road, on Saturday, February 25th, from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. For more information, go to www.oqyc.org.